Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And today we're going to be talking about a key piece of what's often called the American dream, home ownership, specifically single-family home ownership, and in a neighborhood that doesn't allow for any other type of construction. Single-family zoning has been around for at least 100 years. As the name suggests, in such zones or areas, the only residences allowed are those meant to be used by one family at a time. No duplexes, no townhomes, no apartments. This is a popular living arrangement in Illinois, but it's also led to generations of suburban sprawl, which contributes to, among other things, isolation, pollution, countless hours of human misery spent in traffic. Now legislation has been filed here that would gradually prohibit single-family zoning, at least in Illinois' largest communities. We asked members of our texting group what they thought about this. Reaction was mixed. Sally in Champaign says, "I think it's a terrible idea. I am in favor of affordable housing at some level, but to legislate against single-family homes in any city seems absolutely the wrong way to go." Another texter from Urbana says, "There is serious need for affordable housing at varying levels. I'm not sure that outlawing some single-family residences is the way, though I understand the thinking behind it." And finally, Adani in Champaign said, "I'm so supportive of this. In a state where housing costs are rising so much that entire generations are giving up on buying a house, we need building more housing options. If you have an 'Immigrants are welcome here,' 'Black Lives Matter' sign in your yard, you need to be supporting apartments and duplexes in your neighborhood." Joining us now to talk through single-family zoning and this legislation in particular is Norm Van Eden Petersman, Director of Membership and Development for an organization called Strong Towns, which seeks to change the development landscape across North America. Norm, welcome to the 21st Show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be on.
Also joining us, Ben Leroy, an instructor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign College of Law and the Department of Urban and Regional Planning. He's also co-chair of the Legislative Committee of the Illinois Chapter of the American Planning Association. Ben, welcome to the 21st Show to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, you can join our conversation today at 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. Would you welcome a multifamily structure, apartment building on your street? What would this do to the American dream in your view? 800-222-9455. All right, Ben, I want to begin with you. Just tell us a little bit more about the history of single-family zoning. Where does this come from?
Sure. So zoning, modern zoning in America is about 100 years old. 1916 is often credited as a watershed moment in American land use regulation. That's when the city of New York adopted what really the first modern zoning ordinance that divides a city into districts and regulates things like height, density, things like that. 1917 was another important watershed moment in American land use regulation. In 1917, the Supreme Court, in a case called Buchanan versus Worley, outlawed racial zoning, explicit racial zoning. In that case, the city of Louisville, like many cities, had rules about where black residents could purchase property and live and where white residents could purchase property and live. Curiously, or maybe not so curiously, in the years immediately after Buchanan versus Worley, single-family zoning began to spread across the country. One of the first jurisdictions here in the Midwest that adopted single-family zoning was the city of St. Louis. In 1919, Harlan Bartholomew, who was actually a professor at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign Planning Department, as well as a zoning consultant, drafted a zoning plan that St. Louis adopted that instituted widespread single-family zoning. And part of the stated rationale was to prevent the movement of colored persons into, quote, finer residential districts. The idea being that, white homeowners, white residents were generally more financially equipped to own a single-family home, afford the expense of, owning their own building on their own lot. And so it served as sort of a proxy for race-based exclusion, through this exclusionary means of determining how many people get to live on a lot, how many households get to live on a lot.
Yeah, proxy. So I guess in the way we say that today is tell me it's a racist law without saying it's a racist law, right?
Sure. Now, I want to be careful here and say there are many other rationales that people leaned on to support single-family zoning. back in the early days, and certainly until today. So single-family zoning as an institution, I don't want to characterize it as purely a racist institution or, you know, even contemporarily, that's sort of a primary or even secondary factor motivating people's feelings about single-family zoning. But it is important to root it in that historical context that single-family zoning ultimately is a tool of exclusion. It is saying, you know, only the type of people who can afford to own their own home, to afford the expense of having one house on one lot, only those types of people can live in the neighborhood that we've zoned for single-family use.
Okay, so Norm, let me bring you into the conversation now. Maybe you can just talk a little bit about strong towns in general and specifically how, you know, the idea of potentially banning single family zoning fits into the ethos of what strong towns is trying to do.
Yeah, strong towns started as an organization that really emerged from the awareness that the development pattern that we've adopted across North America is very at odds with the traditional way in which cities and towns and villages matured and emerged within various places around the world over centuries of human habitat. And so what we saw happen is that after the Second World War, we saw this massive housing boom, but it was being done in a way that really defied the prior history of how you would build a strong city. You would conserve resources, you would build incrementally out, but also incrementally you would be thickening up existing neighborhoods, you would be repairing homes and densifying them slowly, you would be making sure that there was the nurturing of commercial areas and opportunities so that way you could live near your workplace because many people were on foot or had limited means of transportation. After the Second World War, particularly accelerated by the expansion of the automobile and the abilities that one had to get around rapidly, as well as a lot of subsidies that were directed into this, we created entirely new neighborhoods, all built all at once and all built to a finished state, or what was perceived by the planners in a very top-down way to be the finished state, skipping a lot of the steps, saying we don't need the shacks, the shanties, sort of the marginal types of homes that you would see on the outskirts of communities. Instead, it was, why don't we build brand new, fully complete neighborhoods out there? And so those are our first ring, our second ring, our third ring suburbs. Strong Towns, Chuck Marone of Strong Towns really then began to go out on the road and ask the question, can we continue to afford to build in this way? Or is it actually a pattern of development that is making our communities really weak and fragile? And the numbers bear it out. The amount of looming infrastructure gaps and deficits and liabilities are continuing to grow everywhere. And it's no coincidence that we live at a time where a lot of people realize, hey, I am having to pay more and yet I'm getting less service from my city. How come we can't have nice things anymore is an increasing feeling in a lot of places. Tied into that, Strong Towns as an organization, we're a member-supported nonprofit with members all over the world. And what people are noticing is that there's two patterns, one of strangling exclusion. Prices are skyrocketing in high-growth areas, but then also this rolling blight that's affecting a lot of other places that are really struggling because they're not seeing the types of investment and responses to local needs that are there. And housing really typifies this, where we've locked entire neighborhoods and said, in my city, 80% of the land is reserved for single detached homes. And the average square footage of a U.S. house is 2,500 right now. 2,500 square feet is the equivalent of a Lexus if you went to the car lot. And if the government said you can only buy Lexus or better, you can only buy sort of luxury brands, then you're going to find an increasing pressure for a lot of people to say, I can't afford the options that are available to me. And so what this allows for is not legislating against single family homes per se. It's not legislating against a common type of housing, but it's broadening out the pool of common types of housing options. It's broadening out the possibilities with any given lot to ensure that people have access. And so I know that the language is framed as the language of a ban on these housing options, but it's removing a ban on many alternatives that are reflective of the life cycles that we all go through in our early stages. We can't, you know, if I'm a student, I can't afford a 2,500 square foot home. And if I'm a senior, I don't want to live in a 2,500 square foot home because I want something that's better fit for my purposes. And so one of the observations that Strong Towns is really trying to make clear is that we need to allow the next increment of housing to emerge within neighborhoods by right. And that doesn't mean the removal of a single bit of homes against somebody's will. But what it does do is it gives the option for local builders, local entrepreneurs to be able to construct what's needed in the place where that demand is.
Yeah. All right. So, Ben, let's talk about this specific legislation in Illinois. If people want to look it up, it's House Bill 4795, 4795. What do you make of it? It's got a sort of a gradualism. It only is said to apply to some of the very largest communities in Illinois over the next few years. Take it where you will.
Sure. Thanks. And first of all, I have to credit you for citing the bill number, because I always encourage people to look at legislation, the actual text of the legislation, once they learn about it through a friend, a neighbor, the media, whatever. This bill is in some ways historic for our state, and in some ways represents a catching up to a trend that's already taking place around the country. For about the past decade or so, states across the country have started to dabble in the realm of zoning preemption. And what zoning preemption means is that the state sets minimum standards for how cities can zone themselves. Historically, since zoning really became an institution about 100 years ago, it has largely been left to local control. Localities get to decide how they zone. And, it's up to the voters, it's up to the city councils, the village boards, whatever, to set the zoning. You can imagine what sorts of perspectives have historically been privileged or preferenced in those local political processes. Over the past decade, with the affordability crisis, with concerns about climate, with concerns about sprawl and the environmental damage that it creates, we've seen states across the country start to say, okay, cities, we've tried 100 years of sort of carte blanche local control. It has produced some really bad outcomes. Rather than waiting for you to figure it out and start to make some different choices yourself, we're going to exert our authority and set some minimum standards. Interestingly, this trend is not a partisan trend. In a time of so much political polarization, there is actually bipartisan support for zoning preemption and bipartisan opposition to zoning preemption. So California, a very blue state, has a state with a famous housing crisis, has been really active in the realm of preempting local zoning. Montana, a red state, last year passed some sweeping zoning preemption bills, in part using the rallying cry of keep California zoning out of Montana. So this bill, while it's the first of its kind for Illinois, is part of this trend that we're seeing around the country. To speak about this bill specifically, what this bill does is it sets certain time standards for cities of certain sizes to adopt zoning ordinances that allow what the bill calls middle housing. And briefly, that means basically townhouses or up to fourplexes in neighborhoods. Bigger cities have to meet this threshold, have to enact this zoning requirement first, have to make these zoning reforms first. Smaller cities get to do it a little later. And what I find most interesting about this bill is that this bill also directs IDA, the Illinois Housing Development Authority, to draft a model ordinance that will then stand in for cities that fail to comply in time. The early zoning preemption bills around the state or around the country lacked some enforcement mechanisms, and other states have figured it out. And I think this bill is sort of taking cues from those other states and saying, all right, we're going to tell the cities what they need to do in terms of reforming their local zoning. And if they don't do that, we as the state are going to have a resource that we can supplant and that will stand in if cities fail to take this required action.
You know, in the way of this legislation, Illinois does have a constitutional prohibition on what they call special legislation. So it can't say, okay, this only applies to Chicago, Peoria, Springfield, and, you know, certain Rockford's bigger cities, Naperville maybe. So what they do is they say a city between 100,000 and 500,000 population.
Exactly.
You know, and on these different dates, it can be very confusing for the layperson to read. Can you just give us a sense? I mentioned some of the cities that I think from my reading of it would be affected here. What is your understanding of that?
Yeah. So, and I'm getting to the bill text here. The thresholds in this bill are there's a deadline for cities between 100,000 and 500,000. There's a threshold for cities under 100,000. So cities greater than 100,000 but less than 500,000, those would be, if I recall correctly, things like Joliet, Aurora, maybe Elgin, Rockford. There are six or seven Illinois cities that are between 100,000 and 500,000.
I know Springfield's in there, for example. Peoria, yeah.
That's right. Springfield and Peoria are both there too. Once you get below 100,000, then you're talking about places as diverse as Evanston to Champaign and Urbana to the Illinois side of the Quad Cities to a lot of the cities down in Metro East in St. Louis. And so that takes place, I believe, in 2026, as currently proposed, is when those cities in those class, the under 100,000 class, would need to comply with this law.
All right. So, and I should just mention, we need to take a break here. We did invite the sponsor of this legislation, Democratic State Representative Cam Buckner of Chicago, but the House is in session today. He was not able to join us live on the program. We're going to continue this conversation when we return. We're talking about a proposal, just a proposal at this point, working its way through the General Assembly that would basically allow for or ban, depending on how you want to think about it, multifamily units in areas that are currently zoned for single family only, at least in certain cities in Illinois. We're going to continue this conversation after a short break. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about a proposal in the Illinois General Assembly that would allow for multifamily apartment buildings, townhomes, duplexes, that sort of thing, in certain cities in neighborhoods that are currently only zoned for single family housing. We're talking about this with Norm Van Eden Petersman, who is with the organization Strong Towns, which aims to change and improve the development landscape across North America, and Ben Leroy, who's an instructor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign in the College of Law and the Department of Urban and Regional Planning, also co-chair of the Legislative Committee of the Illinois Chapter of the American Planning Association. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Before we go on, Ben, I understand you wanted to clarify something about the legislation. You were mentioning that during the break.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Yes, so during the break, I had a chance to focus on the text of the legislation. I realize I misspoke in terms of the cities this would apply to. As currently drafted, there are actually only two categories of cities this would apply to. One would be cities over 500,000, which is Chicago, and then one that is cities between 100,000 and 500,000, which are those several larger cities that we talked about. Cities under 100,000 are not implicated by this bill, so I apologize for misstating that.
No, that's an important clarification. Yeah, I think it's like something like eight cities or something
like that.
That's what
yeah.
the sponsor said. Yeah, all right. Let's get to some of the questions that we've gotten from listeners about this. And Norm, I want to ask you about these in particular. Mm-hmm. We heard from Franny in Hinckley, who said she would prefer to keep single family neighborhoods. I wonder what you say to someone who actually likes living in a single family housing area, right? Maybe they're imagining, maybe it's not even a racial thing, right? It could be a socioeconomic class thing or something. They just like the character of their neighborhood the way it is. What do you say to that person?
So the character of a neighborhood is not defined by the type of home that exists within it, but the people that find they can live there, and the types of urban features that people really enjoy, the ability to move around a neighborhood and it being quiet. That has much more to do with the noise of vehicles, as well as leaf blowers and other types of implements, than it does with the actual structure that sits there. There are many remarkable neighborhoods across Illinois that are calm, quiet, and yet because of their pre-war heritage, actually have the mix of different housing types that really make for a great neighborhood, make for great block parties, make for the great types of things that people really appreciate and enjoy. And the challenge is there's also a question of what is it that people have a strong preference for when your preferences are so limited to either living in a large high-rise tower or in a single detached structure. If those are your core options, one within a leafy neighborhood, the other within a bustling cityscape, people have pretty strong opinions where they want to be. But when it's realized that within existing neighborhoods, we can allow them to thicken up, we use the language of infill housing. I always say infill sounds like something you get at the dentist, but what it actually is an investment in your neighborhood rather than it stagnating and sort of either being maintained and kept as it is, or what we often see is older neighborhoods start to lose their shine a little bit. The people are still there, but the investment is sometimes lacking, or sometimes the first wave of the owners have moved on, and then people begin to fear that they're losing their neighborhood, their sense of what it is because of those key features they love. And then sometimes if someone gets permission to build a large structure of or section of townhouses, they're like, well, there goes the neighborhood. When in fact, that's just the next increment or the next iteration of what the neighborhood looks like. And in this bill, the plan is not to allow for wide-scale townhouse development, but instead to say within on existing lots that those lots can be turned into a duplex or turned into a triplex or a quadplex to build a modest number of units in existing neighborhoods on a lot-by-lot basis. And when you do that, the disruption is not nearly so great, and the opportunity that it unlocks is really significant for our neighborhoods.
You know, you're reminding me so much of the neighborhood where my grandparents lived for many years. My grandfather would walk to work at the factory. Literally next door to him was a little grocery store in the front of the house. On the other side was a barber shop. And this was just a block or two south of the Chicago city limits. There's a train that led into the city that was a couple blocks away, a very walkable neighborhood. But even that, you know, it changed over time. Part of that was the white flight story that happened in so many urban neighborhoods in American cities over the past generations. But, you know, like you said, we did get a message from Randy in Peoria, and you mentioned that sort of disinvestment that can happen in some of these older neighborhoods. Randy wondered if this sort of change would require infrastructure investment. Can you speak to that?
So there's always, this is one of the ways that the suburban experiment has sort of front-loaded the costs for infrastructure improvements onto whatever the next round of development in a neighborhood is. So the only time that your pipes get upgraded is if there's a project that is approved and the work is going to happen because our maintenance budgets have been so limited. So there's a challenge that the fault of limited infrastructure within neighborhoods is pre-existing. However, the opportunity that actually is here is as you begin to add additional tax-paying sort of neighbors and residents within a neighborhood, you actually increase the capacity of that neighborhood to be able to cover the costs of upgrades of the types of things that are required. Along the way, I would also say that because of energy performance standards, water, sewer use, those types of things, one of the things that's interesting is that the cost to have someone in a new neighborhood, if you keep your unit sizes more modest, not the 2,500 square foot or 3,500 square foot or 4,500 square foot, but say we bring in some 800 square foot, 900 square foot backyard apartments, things like that, the actual amount of utilities that are used and the services that are required to provide care and the needs for that person is significantly lower. And this is one of the climate benefits of infill development or neighborhood investment that's happening to thicken up existing neighborhoods. There's a great benefit to allowing a neighborhood to thicken. And oftentimes there's a perception that we're at critical max when it comes to our existing infrastructure, our schools, our libraries, our community centers. And it's often used as I would say almost weaponized to say, we can't have any more people because we don't have the infrastructure. And yet change is always happening and things are breaking, but they are being repaired. And we do want to then ask the question, if we add more participants in the process of paying for repairs, are you actually going to be in a better state, in a better position to help an existing neighborhood to improve rather than to be left in its state of continued decline?
Yeah, let's go to the phones now at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Tim is calling from Ogle County, Illinois, on line four. Tim, thanks for calling in.
Thank you. And the point I brought up, we're a rural county within easy driving distance of the western suburbs. And we established the Planning Commission a number of years ago to basically address the issue of us being squeezed out. And as we did our investigation and all that, we basically did the nuts and bolts mathematics of it. What does a new house generate in local taxes, burden on school district, burden on public services, versus what do they generate in tax revenue? And what we found is that basically every new house we brought in was a burden and cost the school district money. So the idea of putting more duplexes, quadruplexes, whatever it may be out here in time, becomes a huge economic burden for the existing residents of the area.
So because more people, it's more drain on the infrastructure. Doesn't it also increase the property tax influx, though?
No, what we found is an inverse of that. Basically, the requirement for services for a rural area like this goes up, and the corresponding taxes did not cover that. So, like we found, every house we built was a burden on the school district.
All right, Tim, thank you for calling in with that. Ben, I wonder if you want to respond to what Tim was saying there.
Yeah, so this kind of fiscal analysis is really important for communities to engage in and for the public to understand. And so, it's something that actually that Strong Towns has been pioneering. One thing I would suggest to the caller and anyone who for whom that message, the caller's message resonates, is to go engage with some of Strong Towns' writings and videos on the financing of development and on the relationship between property tax base and cost of services. It's definitely been the case in communities around the country that when they've done this analysis, they find that single family housing, unless it is really luxury housing, often does cost more to service than it produces in tax revenue. Other forms of development that use infrastructure more efficiently, that are more dense, that use land more efficiently, that don't require us to spread out our sewer pipes and our police coverage, actually minimize that gap and in many cases are actually revenue positive. So this is one of, I think, the most potentially exciting things about allowing our neighborhoods to incrementally densify and to allow, you know, more efficient types of development, is that no longer will local governments have to look at every new resident as a burden, as a drain, but instead that, as Norm said in an earlier response, that we now have more participants who cover their costs better. And it frankly, for me, opens up an exciting opportunity where now, rather than operating in a local government context of budget crisis and budget deficit, now, because we aren't spending all of our wealth on maintaining way too much road and way too much sewer, now we have money to either, you know, we have surplus and we can cut people's taxes, or we can spend that money on really wonderful government services, you know, gold-plated education, mm-hmm. gold-plated libraries, things like that.
Yeah, it sounds like maybe there's somewhere between where the caller Tim was saying and where you're describing, there's got to be a tipping point, right, where incrementally, maybe at first, you know, it's viewed as a burden, but at some point you're going to hit that critical mass. I'd love to get a couple more callers in the time we have remaining. Sarah is calling from Springfield on line one. Sarah, thank you for calling in.
Thank you.
So I understand you have an idea about building an extra home on properties.
Yes. On your very station earlier this morning was a huge discussion about child care and elder care resources and how difficult it was. And one of the ways you could solve that is if you could build a wing or a home on your property for mom or the in-laws. And if you could do that, you would have a much easier time seeing to them, and they could fill in for some of the pieces of child care. That's how it used to be for thousands of years. And in our case, in this society, one in five Americans will be over the age of 60 in six short years. We better get started with something. We can't put everybody in the nursing home.
All right. Thank you so much for sharing your perspective, Sarah. I appreciate that. Let's also go to Jay calling from Mount Zion, Illinois, on line two. Jay, thank you for calling in.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. A couple things that show up to me that I kind of worry about is when you put more people into a smaller area, not only does it, like he was talking about, burden of services, but it also can mean more crime. People who are putting an investment in a home, they're wanting equity back in that home further down the road. And if the neighborhoods are not safe because there's a lot more people in the area, that's a definite drain that drives the property values down. I can see some positive things, but not all of us want to live in high rises or in a small area. We like to be spread out a little bit. That's just my perspective on it.
All right, Jay, thank you so much for calling in. I appreciate that. Norm Van Eden-Petersman with Strong Towns. Do you want to respond to anything that we've been hearing from the callers?
Certainly. I think that I do want to gently suggest that not every populated area is an area that is riddled with or has crime issues. We certainly, I think there's much deeper issues, and it relates less to housing form than it does to other conditions within the region or economic conditions within a place. On the other side, as a buyer, if you became a buyer, what you would be faced with is a lot of different options for single family homes and then very little else. And what this is providing for is the continued ability to purchase single family homes, even in leafy suburbs or places where you say you have space to be able to expand. But it's at the same time not requiring that all other types of development follow the exact same model, because there are many other people for whom the ability to live within a walking distance of a great coffee shop or something that they really value is going to be of sufficient value to them in a way that maybe doesn't square with your own preferences as to what it is that you want. Now, we do want to see what the market looks like as the introduction of new types of housing are introduced. The previous caller, Sarah, talked, I was nodding vigorously as she was talking about the ability to add just a modest number of units in backyards for caregivers or for elderly members of our society or for childcare, other types of uses. And again, that would not restrict the rights of someone to do what they wish with their property. Instead, this is actually removing those restrictions and allowing for a more vigorous type of response to local need, because those needs have been suppressed for so long. And we at Strong Towns, we say your city's housing market needs to be free to respond to your city's evolving needs and capacity. And so it doesn't take things off the table. Crucially, it adds things. And the idea that everyone is forced to move into high rises, we've not seen that. That's not the traditional development pattern. When we don't have these really tight restrictions limiting our housing supply, we don't see an immediate, when we remove them, we don't immediately see towers everywhere. Instead, what we see are the types of things that Sarah was describing, the backyard developments, the reconfiguring of a home so that we have an economy suite for the senior resident that lives there and she rents out the remainder of the home to a young family. Those are the types of things that, again, don't cause anything to happen across the property line. In the next door neighbor, their property remains as it is. But crucially, we've allowed realtors to sell the vision that not only do you buy your home, but you've bought your neighborhood, and you basically get to have your home be as you want it to be modified, but then your neighborhood basically has to remain as is. And that is actually a conflict and a tension. And this bill certainly goes a long ways in helping to address that by saying, you know, within a broad neighborhood, we need to say, if our goal is that our places are finding sufficient housing for a broad spectrum of people, that is going to be of great benefit to us as a state, as a region, as a municipality, and even within a neighborhood. My brother-in-law lives in Winnipeg, and he wrote a great article about his neighborhood called "The Neighborhood Full of Illegals." And it wasn't about immigration status. It was about housing types. It was an older neighborhood, all sorts of different housing types. And the vast majority of them were illegal under the current zoning bylaw that had been regressively added in an attempt, as Ben pointed out, in an attempt to drive certain types of people away. And so when we look and we say there's vibrancy here, we can restore those conditions. And I think it'll be better for everyone.
Well, this is a conversation I'm sure we will continue to have. It's generated a lot of interest out there. Norm Van Eden Petersman is with Strong Towns. We've also been speaking with Ben Leroy, co-chair of the Legislative Committee of the Illinois Chapter of the American Planning Association, also an instructor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
More to come after a short break here on The 21st Show. Do stay with us.